Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Joshua's grandmother was busy putting away baby clothes in his room while he was napping. A large truck rumbled by the open window. Five-month-old Josh woke up, eyes wide open, and turned his head in the direction of the sound. "No trouble with this fellow," his grandmother called out to his mom. "He can hear just fine." From a parent's perspective, how can we tell whether our children can hear adequately, and what should we do if we suspect a problem? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, we are fortunate to have a speech and hearing expert to talk with us. Diane Brewer, certified audiologist, is an associate professor of speech and hearing at George Washington University. A mother of two daughters, she teaches undergraduate and graduate training for speech pathology and audiology. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Before a child can speak, how can parents tell whether he has a hearing problem?
It's pretty hard to tell with a new baby whether they can hear or not because they don't do a lot, as those of us who are parents well remember. And for the first about 3 months, the main thing is, do they respond or startle in response to a loud sound, like the little story that you told? So if there's a strange sound in the environment or a loud sound, the baby should startle, should jerk. The baby should awake from sleep with a very loud sound. And so that's something to watch for in that time period. I should say as an aside, I suppose we've all done this, but often parents bring their baby in because they beat on a pot or pan in the kitchen and want to test the baby's hearing that way. And that's a kind of gross hearing test, and probably we're all scaring our babies a bit with it. But on the other hand, it is that kind of sound, an abrupt sound that they should respond to. So that's the first thing that you would be looking for in that time period. Then as the baby gets a little bit older, 3 to 6 months, you need to be watching for whether the baby seems to respond in particular to the mother's voice. Can the baby have some special response to the mother's voice? If there's a change in sound in the environment, does the baby show interest in that sound? If the baby is able to start turning its head, it should look toward the sound or orient toward the sound. And so that would be something you'd be looking for. Again, the same thing. Loud sound should be responded to. And then the other thing in that time period is that the baby ought to start babbling, cooing, making little noises in this time period. And that's another thing that you would be looking for. Toward about 6 months, when a baby can sit by itself, the baby should really clearly orient toward sound. So if you make a sound more from the right side of their head and they don't see you, they should turn their head and look for that sound. And you should expect that to happen. They clearly should recognize their mother's voice at that point. Probably some words like their name, and they should be starting to look around when you say their name. And there should be lots of babbling, and there should be more than one sound in the babbling. And as the baby gets a little bit older, in the 9 months to a year thing, they should actually imitate you. So what you may remember, if you go up to your baby and go, ba 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 ba, the baby will ba 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 back at you. They'll kind of imitate what you do. And this imitative vocal play, if you will, is characteristic of a normally developing hearing baby.
One of the things that I've heard is that no matter what the native language is of the child, that there are certain sounds that are universal, that mm-hmm. are made, mm-hmm. and then the ones that are not used in that language are filtered out. They don't hear that sound, and so those are ones that just don't exist anymore for them.
Either that or they're not reinforced by hearing the adult say them or hearing the adult respond to them. What most parents do is when they hear anything that vaguely approximates a real word, they're very excited and very responsive to the baby. And so you, in essence, selectively reinforce your language code.
Is there such a thing as universal newborn screening for
yes,
hearing?
Yes, yes. This is a wonderful and exciting new thing in my field and an exciting thing for parents and babies around the United States. There's been a big push, and finally we're getting some success at mandating universal newborn hearing screening. At this point, 10 states in the United States have passed such legislation. There are 5 states that have it pending. And what this will mean is that we'll be able to test most of the babies born in the United States while they're still in the hospital. These would be hospital births, but that accounts for most births in the United States, and know at that time or have a good idea at that time if a baby has a significant hearing loss. And probably a lot of your listeners who are about to have another baby or about to have their first baby will have this done to their baby. It's very easy, non-invasive. The tests that they do with newborns are what are sometimes called electrophysiological, which just means that they hook the baby up to something and the baby doesn't have to do anything. And in fact, for these tests, the baby's usually sleeping. They don't have to do anything at all. One of the most popular ones for this newborn screening is something called otoacoustic emissions, big name. But all that happens is the baby's wheeled in their little isolette to a quiet room. And usually they're swaddled and sleeping at the time. And a little probe is put in their ear, and it's like the otoscope that a doctor uses to look in your ear. That's just placed in the baby's ear. Little clicks are sent in the baby's ear. And because the inner ear in a human has these sensory cells called hair cells that move in response to incoming sound, their movement makes a sound come back out through the ear. And that's what this machine measures. And so this test tells you, do those hair cells move in this baby? And if they don't, then you have concern that there's a hearing problem. The whole thing takes minutes to do.
It's brilliant.
And the baby sleeps through it most of the time. Yeah. It really is. And it's very exciting. And that's what many of these programs are doing. There's another test called ABR, which hooks a couple electrodes on the baby and picks up electrical signals from the brain. But again, the baby can sleep through that. So these are very non-invasive. They don't hurt the baby at all. Mostly the baby doesn't know they had the test because they're sleeping. And you get an indication of hearing status. And then if a baby wouldn't pass that screen, in most of the protocols for the states, they vary slightly. They'd come back in a few weeks for another check, and then the parents would know whether there was a likely hearing loss.
How can parents find out if this kind of screening is available in their home state?
Probably what they can do is call the local health department. What we know from a great deal of research is that the outcome or the possibilities for a baby who's identified and fit with the hearing aid and getting treatment by 6 months is wonderful. And it makes a huge difference because there's a critical language learning period that goes on in the first 2 years of life. In the United States, up until recent times, babies have been 24 to 27 months on average when they've been diagnosed. And that's very late in language development.
If a child seems to have constant ear infections or respiratory illnesses, is she at greater risk for hearing loss?
Yes. One of the big causes of childhood hearing loss that's fluctuating and typically not permanent is ear infections. And ear infections are really the disease of childhood. It's thought that 98 to 100% of all people have an ear infection once during their childhood. Most people, several more times than that. But there's some subset of children who are really prone to ear infections, sometimes called otitis media. And they get a lot of them. And in the course of that ear infection, they will virtually all have some degree of hearing loss. And so what happens for children is that they have a fluctuating hearing loss so that their hearing is good some days and bad other days. And so they have inconsistent auditory input, which has consequences. One, studies have shown, is a consequence if they're quite young in their what's called phonological development, which means their ability to hear, decode, and process speech sounds, like the difference between pa and ta and ka, which matters to reading, which matters to speech, which matters to language development. So that's a problem. In the school years, it's a problem because they inconsistently hear what the teacher says. So that if you had the usual course of an ear infection is about 2 weeks from beginning to end. And in that time period, you might have anywhere from 5 days to 10 days of a hearing loss. But it's intermittent, and so that makes it trickier for the teacher to see, trickier for the parent to see. And it leaves the child with just inconsistency, and so that can present academic problems, especially for a child who maybe has six of these a winter. They might have a hearing loss for 10 weeks during the course of a school year, which is a problem. And just a comment for parents, though, if they have that child, presumably they've been to an audiology clinic and are getting tests and are getting these services, but they really need to be an advocate for their child and explain this to the teacher so the teacher understands the child will have a hearing loss. One of my children has had a lot of ear infections, and so every time she got a cold, I wrote a note to the teacher saying, you know, Kate's having trouble again. Please get her up front, walk around, tell her, write it down for her, if, you know, be sure she gets it, and really advocate for your child because it's hard for the teacher to figure this out.
Can this ever be permanent from ear infections, or it's always
typically
transitory?
Typically, it isn't. It is, though, I should add, too, it's a hearing problem, and I talk about that because it's really sort of my interest. It's also a medical problem, and children who have ear infections need to see their physician. if it's an infection from a cold or an upper respiratory illness, typically they get an antibiotic and it'll clear up, but it needs monitoring because it's a health hazard too. It's not good to be walking around with that. Some children have fluid in their ears. It's not actually an infection from allergies too, and then that requires some work with the pediatrician to decide if an allergist or an otolaryngologist would best help the child deal with those. So there's a medical component too, and a hearing component, and then in turn an educational component.
What are some other risk factors for children in terms of longer-term hearing loss?
Well, I think one set of children are born with hearing loss either because of hereditary factors, hearing loss in the family or some syndrome, or because of something that happened to the mother while she was pregnant, an illness, an infection, the need to take some drug that's toxic to the ear called ototoxic drugs. For those cases, though, probably that would be known because the OBGYN would be monitoring those kind of things, and that mother and baby would be put on something called a high-risk register. And so they would be followed for hearing and maybe some other things because people knew there were issues or things to worry about. So that's one thing. If there's a long history of hearing loss in the family, that hopefully that will have been discussed, but that's something. Children get older. In addition to the otitis media, there are childhood illnesses, though there are very few of those anymore. When I started in the field, measles, mumps, and rubella accounted for a lot of the children with serious hearing loss, and those diseases all but don't exist anymore. Meningitis is another causer of hearing loss, but it's not very common. As children get a lot older, not a lot older, but toward their teens, noise is a cause of hearing loss. And I think that's a real issue. As kids start to go to rock concerts and listen to loud music, there's a lot of evidence that they're potentially permanently harming their hearing by doing that. Another thing, there's some suggestion that's a problem are their personal listening systems, that they turn these little earphones up so loud and listen for so long that they could noise induce a loss that way. Or some children wear them to bed, and they actually, if they have a radio or auto reverse on their system, they may be logging in 8 hours of loud sound, which can be harmful to the auditory systems. I have a sort of a personal story. When my oldest daughter started going to concerts, or got old enough to actually be driven by her parents, when the kids came to our house, I always handed out packets of personal ear protection to go to the concert. And going out the door one time, this one girl said, "Your mother is so weird. My mother talks about drugs. There are going to be drugs there. There's going to be smoking there. And your mother gives out earplugs."
All concerns.
All areas of expertise.
What should we do if we as parents suspect a hearing problem?
What you need to do, I think, is to seek a complete hearing test or what I would call an audiological evaluation. So you should try to seek out a speech and hearing clinic or an audiology clinic and get a full hearing test to assess whether the child or baby does have a hearing loss. The family physician should be able to refer you to such a center. Again, this is a problem with many components. There's a medical component. You certainly need to find out what the cause might be, if it's medically or surgically reversible. Then there's the hearing component, which is what audiologists do to assess the hearing, if there is a hearing loss, to fit the child with a hearing aid and plan a remedial program, and then the educational component.
At one point, one of my children questioned his hearing. He said, "You know, when I'm standing in a group of my friends, I can't keep track of, there's so much going on. I'm beginning to think there's something wrong with my hearing." So we took him and we had his hearing tested, and it was extremely acute. And the problem was he was picking up too much of what was going on around him and was very distracting to him. But I think
listening and noise. And that there's another area which isn't just simple peripheral hearing loss. That's not really what your child had, I'm sure. But some children actually have something called central auditory processing problems. And these are children who don't have the kind of hearing loss I've been talking about so far, the peripheral or outside parts of the auditory system work fine. But at the level of the brain, if you will, the child has trouble picking out a signal from noise, separating which thing they want to listen to. And that central auditory processing disorder is usually not noticed until a child is well along in school. Because again, they don't have a simple hearing loss And that requires a different kind of testing, but again, audiologists do that testing with sort of complicated speech stimuli and background noise and trying to pick out whether they can track things auditorily.
What kinds of therapies are available for that problem?
Typically, a child would work on it. Well, one of the things they would work on are strategies to get around it, because it's a problem that isn't going to quickly disappear. It's a problem they have. And so one of the things that they're going to learn to do and their parents will do until they're old enough to advocate for themselves is to get instructions from the teacher in writing always, not just depend on auditory verbal instructions, so that when there's something going to be on a test or there's something important that happens in the class, that they get it in writing. When oral exams are given in school, they have the option of having a written exam as well. Because some of these children, if it's oral, won't be able to do the answers, but if it's written, they will be able to do it. And so some of the work is actually to teach them how to do that kind of thing. And other therapy has to do with learning to listen in background noise, in other words, playing noise and getting them to focus their attention on the primary signal.
So it's something that can get better over time.
It can get better over time.
But it's also a characteristic of the way that they learn.
Right. Yeah, it falls more in the category of learning areas than in just simple hearing or not hearing. Usually those children have normal hearing.
It's another example, though, of where a child has to learn to be his own advocate.
Absolutely.
And speak up and say,
absolutely,
this is what I need,
yeah,
whether it's in school or in some other,
yes,
situation.
Yes. And I think this is a good point. For children who have hearing loss, it's really important for them to become their own advocates, mm, to try to control the environment and get people to do what they need to help them hear better.
Are these kids who parents should encourage to sit in the front of the classroom pretty much and that kind of thing?
I think that's an appropriate thing to do, yes. And some of the children actually use special listening systems. This would depend. There are systems that were actually devised for hearing impaired children called FM systems, and they are little, basically personal FM radios. And the teacher wears a microphone, the child wears a receiver, and they wear a little, if they don't wear a hearing aid, they'd wear a little, like, personal listening system plug in their ear. Sometimes they interface through hearing aids if they wear hearing aids. And that beams the teacher's voice directly to the child and makes the teacher's voice more intense than the background noise. And that allows the child to focus better. So sometimes those systems are used with children with central auditory processing, not because they have a hearing loss, but because they have a focus problem, if you will. That's not always the case, and that would be decided on an individual basis based on the child, though.
Are there times during childhood when hearing should be routinely tested?
Yes. The guidelines that audiology uses are, well, first of all, we'd like to see universal newborn screening in all of the states. And then between that time and the next time children are captive, if you will, at school age, any child who has any family history, any concern, any parent concern should be seen right away. Then when they start school, annual testing between pre-K or K, depending on the system, through third grade is recommended. And the reason it's recommended every year in that time period is that's sort of the building blocks of education. You, by fourth grade, have the basic functions of math. You basically can read. You have basic school skills, and then you expand it from fourth grade. So missing something in those years is quite handicapping, and so it's really important to be able to hear. Also, those years are the peak years for ear infection. Ear infections go up, peak usually when kids start school, within the first year of starting school, whatever that year is. And between about 9 and 11, they fall back off again. And so the incidence of ear infections drops, just like all illness drops. Upper respiratory infections drop off in that age range as the child's immune system builds up. So those are years where kids are likely to have transitory hearing loss, too. So it's good to identify them. And then the other point is usually where there's a school change, maybe 7th grade and 11th grade, when they're about to move into another school system as they go to middle school or as they go to high school and before they leave high school to be sure that everything's okay. Yeah. And the reason you would keep doing it then, I want to make one other point, is there is this possibility that, to be sure, this is a limited number of people, but some people have a hereditary factor that's late onset hearing loss. And so the hearing loss actually doesn't start until they're 11, 12, 13 years old. And so that's a possibility. So you want to recheck later on because there are this small number of people who have that late onset deafness, it's sometimes called.
Diane, what happens when a family is told that a child does have a hearing impairment? What kind of choices do they then face?
Well, there are several things to consider. First, I'd like to make the point, because I'm going to talk a little bit more about severe hearing loss. Overwhelmingly, children have mild to moderate hearing loss. Most children are not deaf.
Very reassuring.
And probably it's somewhere between 1 and 2% of hearing loss is profound, or what we would intuitively call deaf. So the majority of children with hearing loss are going to be fit with hearing aids. They're going to be put in a therapy program that works with the child, that works with the parents, that teaches them to be wonderful language teachers. And they're going to go to their neighborhood school or whatever school they would have gone to, and they're going to do fine and with support. For the children who are at the profound end, there may be some other decisions about communication style and what educational system you want. And that would include whether the choices would be oral, aural, which means you listen and talk, like the child I just described. The second choice would be to use sign language, which is using your hands to talk, and it's a different language. It's not English. It's a complete whole language on its own and a rich, wonderful language. And then the third choice would be something called total communication, which is using sign language and talking at the same time. And once you made one of those choices, you would go, in all likelihood, to a different school based on that choice. So in any state, there are available oral-aural programs for hearing impaired. There are total communication programs, and there are sign language programs, but they're probably not at the same school, and they're probably not at the end of your block.
Seems like an overwhelming decision.
It's huge. It's a lot for a parent, and one of the things I would say is that parents really need to explore all of these choices, and one of the ways they're going to find out about that is when they have their hearing test, when they find out that their child has a hearing loss, the audiologist should talk to them about their own community and what's available there and what they could go see and look at. There are a lot of books. There's some videos that present these choices. And then visiting is always a good avenue. And I think one of the things is each of the choices is a good choice. They're not good or bad choices, but they're probably unique to the child, the family, in the community. And so what's a good choice for one family might not be a good choice for another. One other thing that makes it a bit harder for the parent of a hearing impaired child is all parents face decisions about school, such as, shall we go to nursery school or shan't we go to nursery school? Do we go at 4? Do we go at 3? Do we go to playgroup? What do we do? But you can go to the park and find out what the word is on that. I mean, all you have to do is find somebody else with a baby to know. If you go to the park, you're probably not going to find another mother with a hearing impaired child. And so it's harder to get the information for these families. But there are parent groups in most communities. You just need to get the professional to help you get in touch with the resources in your community to explore the choices.
Do you have some kind of a phone number that would help people?
I do. The phone number I'm going to give is an 800 number, and it's the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, which is the professional association for people in the field of audiology and speech pathology. Their number is 1-800-638-8255. And if a parent would mention they have a hearing concern or they're concerned about their baby's hearing, they have some literature that they can send them. This organization also could put them in touch with an audiology clinic in their community wherever they live.
Would you repeat the name of the organization and the telephone number?
Sure. Its acronym is ASHA, and it's American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association. And the number is 1-800-638-8255.
Thanks.
That's a number that parents are going to be very happy to have if they have this issue come up. We've enjoyed so much talking with Diane Brewer today about children's hearing, and we thank you for all your insight and advice.
Thank you.
Our gift for caller number 2 on our listeners' poll is Dr. T. Barry Brazelton's book, Touch Points. Call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 to answer the following question. What help does your community offer to families with a hearing impaired child?
Call us at 1-800-791-8573. We'd like to send you Dr. Brazelton's wonderful book of parenting advice. For other comments or questions, you can reach Parents Perspective through your local station or by email at parentspr@aol.com. You can also visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. I'll repeat it. It's a short website address, http://i.am/parentsperspective, for a look at our show topics and our book, Parents as Mentors. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.